So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
Here we go, ladies and gentlemen. His debut.
Rookie.
Now there's going to be the man right there. That's Blue Chipper right there.
You know what? I have to agree with you, Jim Ross. I don't like you, but I got to agree with you. Rocky Maivia is looking good.
First third-generation WWF superstar ever. His father really made a name for himself here in Madison Square Garden. So did his grandfather, Rocky Maivia. I see Peter Maivia, the grandfather of that young man. Rocky Johnson, his dad, former WWF tag champion.
Well, if he's anything like his father or his grandfather, we're going to have a future superstar in our hands. That's what
I'm saying. And again, you wonder whether or not he has butterflies.
Rocky Maivia with Goldust.
Shoulder breaker.
And down. One, two.
I can't
believe it.
Here is your winner.
Oh, my God.
Rocky,
I feel like my name should be
Maivia.
Adrian.
What a way to make your debut with a big show. In the Big Apple at the Survivor Series.
What a dream come true for this first third-generation WWF superstar. And how proud is Rocky Johnson and his mom? How proud are mom and dad sitting in Florida watching this on pay-per-view, JR?
They got to be loving his grandma watching in Hawaii. And I'm sure the high chief is looking on with a big smile on his face.
Well, you know, I'm proud of him, too, and I haven't even gotten the chance to seduce him yet.
Yeah, boy, she has dollar signs in her eyes.
Oh, boy, what a look Sonny just gave Rocky Maivia.
Stop the run. Can't stop the run. Can't stop the run.
Welcome to Review Away, everyone. It's John Pollock, and for the third straight week, the Score's own Arta Ocal joining us.
That's right. Wei Ting, when you get back from vacation, my friend, I'm going to make sure you don't get back in the country so I can keep doing this.
Legit heat here between Wei Ting and Arta Ocal.
This is as legit as it gets, all right?
Wei Ting's going to be back next week, and I think you've definitely gotten comfortable in this chair.
Oh, I already feel like I'm part of the show. Actually, I'm just going to show up, and I'm going to be like, what are you doing here, Wei?
What's going on? Like a first cousin here to the
That's right.
The family.
I've solidified myself at every opportunity. If Wei is late, I'm going to make sure I show up on time for all of your future tapings. If Wei is even 2 minutes late, I will make sure that we are already started.
Wei is not a man for time. He doesn't live in a world of watches and clocks.
Excellent. This is all to my favor, John. Woo!
So we've got Survivor Series 96 coming up. Fall Brawl and Super Clash. I don't think we could fall below Super Clash here.
No, that was an emphatic zero. And this wasn't a zero.
This was not a zero. Absolutely.
It wasn't a 10, but it wasn't a zero.
A very fun show to go back and watch. Now, first of all, I had this somewhere in my storage on VHS. Meaning the free-for-all was attached to it.
And I watched it too.
Oh, did you? This was quite the
How
trip.
Couldn't you? Where the roadie's singing with my baby tonight to the ring. Of course you want to watch
J.
the free-for-all.
So here we go. We're going to get right into things here. Survivor Series 96. November the 17th of that year from Madison Square Garden, New York City. Our announcers for the free-for-all, Vince McMahon and Jim Ross. And this was right around the time Jim Ross was playing his pseudo-heel character, where he had introduced Rick Titan and Glenn Jacobs as Razor Ramon and Diesel. And he did this big rant on Vince McMahon. It was like he was the precursor to what we got from CM Punk. Just going off on the company and how he was treated.
Almost the precursor to Michael Cole, but Michael Cole should take notes because I actually cared to listen to when it came to. And I know I'm foreshadowing, and I always do this, but when we got to Austin and Brett, JR became the commentator we all know and love. So there's the big difference. There's the big difference right there, right?
Yeah, it was very weird because Ross every now and then would get in his little jabs at Vince, and Vince would just do his little chatter laugh. It was just ridiculous. I just made up a term there. The free-for-all featured a 8-person traditional Survivor Series match. We had the gimmicks of all gimmicks in this match. the real Jesse James, yep. the real Double J, teaming with Aldo Montoya.
The real Aldo Montoya.
Bob Hawley.
Yep. Bart, as spark plug.
Bart Gunn taking on Justin Hawk Bradshaw, accompanied by Uncle Zebekiah. The Sultan with the Iron Sheik, Salvatore Sincere, and Billy Gunn. And the first thing I noted here was how all of these guys, almost all of them, would have, you know, a modicum of success in the mid-card during the Attitude Era by completely ditching these gimmicks and basically poking fun at them later on.
Well, except for Tom Brandy.
Tom Brandy would not have quite the run throughout his career, but that was interesting to
know. That's
a
good point, though. You're right.
Look at this. We had Road Dogg. We had Just Incredible. We had the
Hardcore
Holly. Bart Gunn, who would play Butterbean's victim.
Yep.
Then we had Bradshaw and later JBL, Rikishi.
Yep.
And this was and then badass Billy Gunn here. This was quite the makeover all these guys got at one point or another.
I just want to note that Billy Gunn wore his heel black cowboy hat.
Black hat. And then the announcers explained the significance of a black hat. Thanks, guys. Subtlety 101 presented by the WWF. McMahon makes a joke about Jim Ross having an ego at one point here, just in passing. And Ross notes this is his first show at Madison Square Garden, believe it or not. And that's when I noted Billy came in his black hat. We start off the match. The Sultan remained on his feet here as he worked with Aldo Montoya until he took the crippling flying forearm, which sent him to the floor. Sultan then hit a jumping pile driver to Montoya and then into the camel clutch for the elimination about 3 minutes in. I believe someone in the 10th row dropped a pin here during this match,
yep,
because I could detect it. Midway through this match, it was so important, we cut away to promos for the pay-per-view, and then
which were
back.
Amazing promos, by yes. the way. The Austin-Brett promos were phenomenal.
Did you sleep good last night, Brett?
It's time.
And are you going to sleep tonight?
They say people dream in black and white.
What are you going to see when you close your eyes?
I'll tell you what you're going to see.
My fist in your face and my foot in your as I kick the hell out of you all over New York.
Wake up, Brett.
It's time, Brett.
It's 3:16, Brett.
Well, they say people dream in black and white.
Wake up, Brett.
It's time. But tonight, Hitman, you're going to dream in
it's
red.
It's 3:16,
it's
Brett.
It's 3:16, Brett. Time to whip your...
Very good at that point, and it was just simply, you know, the legend returns tonight, and it was just, here it is, your dream match here with Bret Hart and Steve Austin, and definitely got you intrigued here on the pre-show. Salvatore Sincere, was it just me, or was this guy like a carbon copy of Tom Zenk, like 10 years later? Holy
pink.
Shit, like right down to the mullet and the look. We saw a side suplex by Bart Gunn to eliminate Sincere. First time I think a side suplex has led to a finish.
Absolutely.
Then we go to the insert with Doc Hendricks in the back. Now, moments before, McMahon and Ross had just informed us that the winner of Hart and Austin was going to get a WWF title shot. And then we throw to the back where Doc Hendricks, breaking news here, the winner of Steve Austin and Bret Hart is going to receive a WWF title shot.
Communication 101.
Walks into Austin's locker room, Austin throws him out, and then McMahon says, well, I believe we had just told everybody that, but nonetheless... Bradshaw then eliminates Holly with what would later become the clothesline from hell. Jesse James runs in, rolls up Bradshaw for a two count, but this was considered a three, and Bradshaw was gone.
The shoulders were clearly up, John.
Yes.
I was infuriated at this point.
Just in case you weren't sure if it was a blown spot, they replayed it from that angle.
They replayed
it. So you got to see for sure. And this began Jim Ross's show-long tirade against the officiating. Billy Gunn then... Jesse James was eliminated after... A rocker dropper from Billy Gunn, and this came after James had eliminated the Sultan with a small package. Came down to Billy and Bart. Bart got tied in the ropes, got slapped by Billy. This was my highlight of the match. Billy called him a son of a bitch, and Jim Ross says, how could someone say that about their own brother? A great point.
Very good point. And I think it was Vince McMahon that said, our cameras are getting a little too close to the action, and which...
They would later with Shawn Michaels dropping a few bombs on television.
Yes.
And then Bart came out of the corner, hit Billy with a forearm, and got the win. 10 minutes and 47 seconds as Bart Gunn is our sole survivor.
Wow.
If this wasn't a tease to buy the pay-per-view, I don't know what was.
Now, the only reason anyone would have ever bought the pay-per-view watching this would be the Austin and Brett promos, which were fantastic. They could have played that for half the free-for-all, and people would have been enticed.
Yeah, it really it came across like Austin and Brett was the real big draw on this show, even ahead of Sean and Sid. And a promo for Sean and Sid is what came on after this. And we finished off the free-for-all with Doc Hendricks chatting with Billy Gunn backstage. Billy Gunn says he carried the smoking guns. He's the top gun in the WWF, calls it a fluke. He yells. He clearly had to kill some time here and act. He said, I'm really, really mad.
And before he said that, he said, you've got nowhere to run because... So you got nowhere to run because I'm mad. Just to be clear, he's got nowhere to run because he's mad.
Vince then just like cut this promo off. He's like, enough of this guy. And
I actually kind of liked the Vince and JR UFC pre-pay-per-view like analysis of the matches. Like that actually added some value.
I would have loved if we got like Vince and Jim Ross doing the Dana White, Joe Rogan hard sell they do at the end of the
prelims
now. Where they just yell like this because this match is going to be crazy.
Oh my God, Chael Sonnen, what a loquacious individual. My God, his ground game is superlative.
Those hard sells during the final 3 minutes are like, they've become the highlight of UFC shows for me now, is Dana and Rogan at the end of the prelims. And then we go into the pay-per-view portion, and Jerry Lawler is...
Oh, we missed the Undertaker voiceover promo. Was that not important?
I fast-forwarded through the sending part. I don't even know what
he did a voiceover.
Here.
He wasn't even in the arena. He just did a voiceover to the audience, like, oh, the creatures of the night. Ah.
How ominous. So the show starts off. Title sponsor, Karate Fighters.
Do you remember the promos? Mr. Perfect versus this, and he'd like cheat at the Karate Fighters game?
Didn't they do that big tournament on TV?
Yeah, that's Sable one?
Or something like that? It came down to like Sable and I think Jerry Lawler. Karate Fighters. Something that did not really catch on. It was like the fucking Tamagotchis of WWF.
Yes, exactly. Well, at least they had the Karate Fighters blimp.
I hated those fucking blimps. I always thought if I was in an arena with a goddamn blimp circulating around, it would have driven me crazy.
I would have thrown a dart or something if I could have.
Was someone ever in those blimps, or was it just operated? These are the questions I want to know.
Yeah.
The blimp mystery.
That's where Jimmy Corderas was in this pay-per-view. He actually wasn't working in this pay-per-view, so he was operating the blimp.
He was on blimp patrol.
Yeah.
So we got Vince McMahon, Jim Ross, and Jerry Lawler. We go into our first match. It is a Survivor Series elimination match. The British Bulldog, Owen Hart, Marty Jannetty, and Leif Cassidy, as the new Rockers, taking on the Godwins and the debuting Phil LaFon and Doug Furness. British Bulldogs sporting quite the physique in this match.
Oh, man.
Holy cow. Ross and Lawler begin to argue here, and this was hilarious because as the match starts, Ross and Lawler are arguing. McMahon just stops it and saying, let's focus on the match in the ring, which is just hilarious considering the current state of commentary in the WWE, where we have this problem and the puppet master in the back is Vince McMahon here taking away the attention. Jannetty, at one point, starts doing this really weird dance in the ring, and Jim Ross just outright calls him a geek. And we got some good technical work here from Leif Cassidy, Al Snow, in with Phil LaFon. And the heels then isolated Vinius in the corner. The first elimination was Jannetty after he took the slop bucket by Mark Henry, by Henry Godwin. Mm. And then Owen comes in immediately with a reverse heel kick, and he eliminates Henry Godwin. Bulldog is in, hits a running power slam to eliminate Vinius, and then it's... down here to Doug Furness coming in, goes for a leaping drop kick, but Bulldog just kind of awkwardly runs out of the way. I thought Furness and LaFon, it was like these guys were kind of, they didn't have much leading into this. They were kind of just debuting cold here, and they were kind of just left to their in-ring work to get over.
Which
here.
Wasn't bad.
It was very good.
I agree with you, though. On commentary, they were really pushing these guys as, they're the next title contenders. Look at how good they're doing against the tag team champions.
And the crowd, they were kind of like sitting on their hands for these guys because they didn't know them, but by the end of the match, clearly had them. LaFon, I think the turning point was this one spot where we saw LaFon... he had Cassidy seated on the top rope and gave him like a reverse vertical suplex off the top to the mat, and the crowd just went nuts for this spot here. And you had a guy like Al Snow, who I'm sure was willing to take this bump, and it really helped them, I think, get over in this match. Then Furness got kind of the surprise pin on Bulldog, and it came down to Furness and LaFon against Owen Hart. A little weird. You want to get these two guys over, but it's like here they are outnumbering the heel here at the end of it.
I probably would have done a double pin. Like two impressive moves and then pin them
right,
both at the
exactly.
same time.
It's just like suddenly Owen Hart here is the one in the underdog role. It just seemed kind of backwards. And Owen went for the sharpshooter on LaFon. Furnace comes in to stop it. And then Furnace hit this great looking drop kick, hit a belly to belly overhead suplex, and then a released German with Owen landing on his sternum. And they pin Owen 20 minutes and 39 seconds. And by the end of this, I thought Furnace and LaFon really got over in this match and pinning the tag champions, getting a push right off the bat in Madison Square Garden.
And mind you, they never got the titles, but anyway.
Nope, they got a gimmick of being boring, which did wonders for them.
One thing that I noted in this match was you never hear Jerry Lawler called J.R. Ross, which I thought seemed out of place if you watch WWE today, and then you go back to this, and he's like, just because he's a heel commentator, he's calling J.R. Ross. Like, I don't agree with you, Ross. Like, it just seems so weird to hear that.
It's so funny going back to these older ones where, yeah, Ross and Lawler were positioned as, like, opposites, and now they're, like, best friends on the broadcast.
We got one of our Vince McMahonisms, of course, What a Maneuver.
Oh, that
CM Punk reminded us.
This was like a drinking game for wrestling
exactly.
fans.
We this one, in this match, we got the 1-2, he got him, didn't he? Did he get him?
I always love the oversell of Vince calling a three count for a near fall. Mm-hmm. 1-2-3, he's got him, he's won. No.
It
was
oh,
just
no.
Like this abrupt no. Oh. Thank God we got an Ahmed Johnson promo on this show. Rougeau is in the back with Ahmed, who says his suspension is up in one day. And it was so hard to understand this guy. And they said that he'd be on the superstar line all night long, which had to have been an inside rib, putting this guy on the superstar line.
First of all, I'd say that you're going down.
Like, what the hell are you saying, Ahmed?
He'd have his big 2x4 when he came back and his spandex.
All right, Ahmed Johnson, the question going through everyone's mind is, when will you return to the ring?
You know, Ray, it's funny you ask that. My suspension's up in one day. One day, my suspension's up. And you know that one day is party time.
All right, then what? Is Farouk your business, right?
You know what? Don't ask me a question that you don't answer to. Farouk is no more. He's finished. And then my belt will come back where it belongs.
All right, Ahmed, are you ready to answer some real tough questions here on the Superstar Line tonight?
No, Ray, I got some questions I want to ask you. I got some things I want to tell you that you don't know about Ahmed Johnson. Some things going inside my head when I get back.
And by the way, I don't like him as Ezekiel Jackson either.
He's had a whole reincarnation in today's WWE.
By the way, I didn't get this promo. I got a Coliseum video exclusive with Kevin Kelly before the show started with Rocky Maivia. I don't know if that's in your notes.
No, that wasn't here.
I watched a different feed then. I didn't watch the original VHS.
I think this
VHS.
Was the actual pay-per-view feed.
Oh, really? Okay, I got the Coliseum video exclusive
they
then.
They edited Ahmed off. Awesome.
I didn't get that promo, so I was like, oh, nice. Okay.
I got here, I don't know if you saw that, Kevin Kelly in the boiler room here.
Oh, yes.
Mankind and Paul Bear, and Mankind says he is going to eat The Undertaker alive. The cannibal.
I'm not going in a cage. I'm Paul Bear and you're not.
Paul Bear was so great.
I'm Paul Bear and you're not. Like, and that's why I'm not going in a cage.
The Chevy Chase insult here. You are not me, you underachiever.
Although I will say this, it did remind me that, remember how awesome it was when Mankind had a separate entrance and exit music?
That's right.
With the piano. I thought that was the coolest thing ever.
It was a really strong character. I was really into Mankind when he first debuted. And that takes us to our next match here. Mankind with Paul Bearer in a cage hung above the ring, taking on The Undertaker, who had been gone, I guess, since the Buried Alive match the prior month. So this metamorphosis of The Undertaker, he came back in leather, rappelling from the ceiling. So apparently he was inundated with, I guess he was watching old Tim Burton movies and maybe was watching Nitro at the time.
Probably.
With Sting.
Yeah.
Was Sting rappelling by this point? In
97, I think, right? Maybe.
Was that when he started? Because he did the whole...
Starrcade 97 was the match, Hogan and Sting. So I don't know if he was rappelling at this time.
Anyway, so maybe WCW stole it.
Can someone please tell us?
Oh, it's wrestling fans. They won't point out if we have something wrong, we state. Ross is impressed by Undertaker and his drop toehold early on, saying, this is something we have never seen from The Undertaker.
And moments before that, he goes, we won't see any catch-as-can wrestling in this contest. It's almost as if The Undertaker heard that and said, you know what, I'm going to rib this guy, and I'm going to throw in a drop toehold in this brawl.
Into a straight armbar.
In this brawl.
We see an actual armbar here applied by The Undertaker in 1996. They fought into the crowd. Taker's face looked like he had just been doused in powder prior to this match. He looked like ghost white here. Mankind cuts off The Undertaker with a pile driver, and then Taker blocks the mandible claw, goes for a tombstone, but Mankind counters and applies the claw, but gets tossed to the floor. Taker then scaled the top rope for what is now known as old school, which I guess would be, what, middle school at this point?
Middle school, yeah.
Yeah. They pointed out that this is the event that The Undertaker debuted at 6 years ago. It's like, fuck, is this an old event? 6 years since The Undertaker's debut in 1990.
It wasn't even a decade of destruction at that
time. No, it was barely an Olympic cycle.
That's right.
Mankind then hits a swinging neck breaker.
Barely an Olympic cycle. Astute observation, John.
Mankind comes off the top rope into a choke slam attempt, but then Mankind counters with the mandible claw. Undertaker goes down, but his arm stays up for the three, then breaks the hold with the mandible claw, and Mankind grabs this foreign object, and he's trying to stab Taker. Taker then just lifts him up for the tombstone, hits it, and gets the win, 14 minutes and 53 seconds. An okay match, I thought. Not the best I've seen these two have, but not the worst.
No, but the good thing was that you had the technical opener, and then you had the brawl, so the booking made sense. One thing I do want to mention, though, the Undertaker's teardrop.
Lame.
That, what is the purpose of that? Like, I understand, like, the tattoo means, I guess, you killed someone or you're in a gang or something like that, but why would the Undertaker have a teardrop? I don't understand.
He was, gang-affiliated? Was influenced by Mark Calloway.
I don't get it.
I don't know either. Yeah, the tear, it means a lot. Undertaker's had a lot of, like, subtle, like, gang references with throughout his, like, the TCB he used to do. I remember we were doing a review about the TCB, and this guy from Quebec emailed me about all the gang references to TCB. It's like this crazy gang in Quebec that's like murdered people.
Good to know.
That's something you want to be promoting.
And then he was a biker at one time, of course.
Yes. After the match, Undertaker tries to get his hands on Paul Bearer, but Terry Gordy, the executioner, runs in and attacks him as Paul Bearer escapes, and this would lead to the infamous Undertaker executioner match the following month at In Your House, officiated by none other than Jimmy Corderas.
And his debut and his most prized appearance in Botchamania.
Yes. So there. Look it up.
Everyone. Attaboy, Jimmy. Way to go. You're bald.
Jimmy Corderas, though, is he has he big-timed you yet since his big explosion after the MTV VMAs? And
oh, yeah, the Hollywood quoted? Reporter. My
the Hollywood
God.
Reporter.
And the best part is I honestly think that that reporter doesn't know who Jimmy Corderas is because she just said – I think she just went – and searched Lady Gaga on Twitter, and he happened to be a comment that she picked.
Amazing.
Out of millions. And it just says, da-da-da-da, said Jimmy Corderas. Like, either she thinks that he's so famous that he doesn't need an explanation, like no WWE referee is necessary, or she doesn't know who he is.
It's amazing how easy it is in certain outlets now to be, like, to be an online blogger or journalist where you can simply search your subject and find quotes from people and insert them into your story.
Yeah.
It's so easy now to do so little work for a story.
Journalism has never been so simple, John.
We're so proud of...
Facts?
Fuck them. Furnace and LaFawn are chatting with America Online with the WWF.com crew.
Fuck, I missed all this. Stupid Coliseum video taking shit out.
I'm pretty sure this was Phil Spear here manning the chat here for America Online. And I gotta say, Phil LaFawn, after this match, he put this white scarf on, and my God, the resemblance to Alberto Del Rio is scary here.
Well, now we know who he stole it from.
There you go. Sonny then comes out.
Yeah, I gotta go.
Let's see.
Although my favorite part of the pay-per-view is coming up, though.
Let's see if me and Arda can get through this next match without any inside jokes. Sonny comes out.
You really should have shot the footage, John.
Yes.
that lasted all of 5 seconds. She stole our ring truck.
This match brought to you by LCBO. She comes out. joins the commentary table. This was so weird. It's like Sunny comes out and these like male fans are reaching out to like touch her. And then as she got to the ring, she would like scale the side of the ring so that the guys couldn't touch her. It's just so weird that these guys have paid for tickets to try and touch a woman. It was a little unsettling. So we... she comes down, joins the commentary table, and then we go backstage. Doc Hendricks is with the team of Triple H, Goldust, Jerry Lawler, and Crush. Hunter does his Greenwich snob voice. Whether this was intentional or not, Lawler referred to Henry as Big Mark Henry as well, and then Crush calls themselves a well-oiled machine, and then the announcers note that Hunter gave a look to Marlena, and I'm like, if they had this feud between Hunter and Goldust already mapped out, this was quite the subtle little hint of something that was not going to actualize until a few pay-per-views down the road. It was like, wow.
At least they foreshadowed.
You could hope for as little today.
Yes.
Where they were like, this is where we're going in 2 months, and Hunter is simply going to look at Marlena, and this is going to lead to our Royal Rumble and then WrestleMania match between these two. Amazing. So we got Crush, Jerry Lawler, Goldust, and Triple H taking on Mark Marrow, the stalker Barry Windham.
Who was the best dressed guy on this pay-per-view,
by the way.
He dressed up for this match like he showed up to the arena. Honestly, he's like Zubaz pants and a cut-off WWF t-shirt.
And a mustache.
And a mustache. Like, he was missing the fanny pack. That's all he was missing.
Don't forget the lucky boots.
Yeah, the lucky boots, exactly.
And they were joined by the Blue Chipper, making his debut, Rocky Maivia.
Wow.
Who was accompanied by his hair. And Marrow gets on the stick. He says, you guys don't think I would have come into battle here with only three people. No, we have a fourth. And I had a revelation. And they introduce Jake Roberts, who comes out with his snake. And Ross here is just egging on Sonny. And that was the entertaining part of this, was just Jim Ross, like, breaking Sonny's balls, which I know technically doesn't make sense. And
oh,
says,
no, it makes perfect sense.
Ross says that Sable is the most beautiful woman in the WWF, and Sonny then takes this knock at Sable, saying she better be careful about Marrow's pyro, because her implants could be flammable.
Uh-huh.
And then Ross makes mention of Sonny's own implants, and she starts defending her...
I'm natural from head to toe, even my extensions, my hair extensions.
Yeah. It was always funny how Sonny...
This was my favorite part of the pay-per-view. Austin and Brett could have been the best match ever. This is my favorite part of the pay-per-view.
Just
when
Ross
JR
and
just absolutely buries Sonny considerably.
It was hilarious. Marrow then... that's when he introduces Jake. Sonny, apparently when Lawler went into the ring, he left his joke book in his seat, because Sonny then said, Jake Roberts wanted to be a lawyer, but he couldn't pass the bar.
Wow.
Ooh, rough. Vince says, if anything big ever happens in sports entertainment, it's here in Madison Square Garden, which I typed into to Lexus online, and it translated to, fuck you, WCW.
Uh-huh.
Who were shut out of Madison Square Garden.
Yes.
Wyndham here. Oh, my God. This had to have been one of the worst gimmicks. The stalker.
The stalker of what? Old school wrestling backstage attire? Like, he didn't even look like a guy that...
He was in army fatigue, so you weren't supposed to see his legs.
Oh, my God.
He was
God.
This floating torso.
That's what JR even said. He's like, what? He's well-dressed for hunting.
What's he hunting?
Oh, my God.
Oh, perhaps a
rats.
Carver for his
That's
mustache.
That's what he's hunting. He's hunting rats.
Rocky Maivia is in there with Lawler. He gets knocked down, does his kip-up spot, and Lawler's sent to the floor after a big drop kick.
And by the way, Lawler bumped his ass off for Rocky. I mean, if there's anybody that made Rocky look good in this match, it's Jerry Lawler.
I thought Maivia showed, like, good kind of babyface fire here during the match. I mean, you watch this guy, and, I mean, he did seem to click right away, but not to the... I don't think anybody in their wildest dreams imagined this guy getting to the level he would, but, the crowd seemed into Rocky here at the start. The heels got the heat on Maivia as his afro would form here on top of his head. Built to this hot tag to Jake. Crowd got super heated when he called for the DDT, but Hunter avoided the DDT. Jake was actually got the first elimination after hitting Lawler with the DDT about 10 minutes in. Ross then brought up that Wyndham is wearing his lucky boots, And Ross says that he's won some big matches outside of the WWF. And there was just silence, and we moved on.
Yep.
Because nothing exists outside of this company. Wyndham then gets hit in the back of the head by Crush, then takes the curtain call by Goldust, and Barry Wyndham disappeared, just like his pants would suggest.
Yeah, poor fat Spike Dudley gets eliminated.
We see the ever so fun hesitation sunset flip where Hunter was struggling, tag Goldust, and then gets rolled over by Mero. Mero then hit his Mero salt off the top to pin Hunter, and then we see them putting over Mero for pinning the IC champion in Triple H. Then Mero went for a spinning plancha to the floor, landed badly as Crush just got out of the way and Mero crashed on the ground, and Mero actually got counted out here to be eliminated. Crush then delivered the heart punch, the devastating heart punch, Arda.
In 96.
And this eliminated Jake Roberts, and then it's down to...
But that, if there's any move that would legitimately eliminate Jake Roberts, it's the heart punch, let's be honest. Especially in 1996.
He's put pressure on his organs. It's down to Crush and Goldust against Rocky Maivia. This made sense. Two heels against the babyface. Crowd was actually chanting Rocky here.
And Sonny with the line of the night, 2-on-1 sounds kind of good.
Oh, my God. I missed that.
Uh-huh.
Art is always on top of those ones. Goldust holds up Maivia, and Crush goes for the heart punch, and imagine what happened. The babyface ducked, and Goldust got hit with the heart punch, and this led to Maivia hitting a cross body to eliminate Crush. And then Maivia hit Goldust with the shoulder breaker, and Rocky Maivia is the sole survivor at 23 minutes and 45 seconds. And a strong debut here for Rocky. You could definitely, you got the sense in these first two matches that the company was trying to build a lot of new faces with LaFon, Furnace, and here again, Rocky Maivia. And kind of using a guy like a legend in Jake Roberts, and we'd see later with Snuka to try and get the older fans, but leave the focus on these newer talents. And even the Austin Brett would be another good example of that.
Yeah, exactly. I think that they did a very good job with that. Of course, it wouldn't pan out the same way for Mr. Rocky Maivia, but we all know the story. This match also reintroduced us to Vince McMahon's back body drop.
I've got to say, I smirked at John Cena ribbing Tony Chimmel about the Super SmackDown. I immediately thought of your interview with Edge.
Yeah, it was good.
We then go to the promo for Bret Hart and Steve Austin again, and Austin's, quote, campaign of terror. Todd Pettengill's with Steve Austin.
Notwithstanding the special stipulations that have been added to the matchup, in seconds, you are going to face the legendary Bret the Hitman Hart, the excellence of execution. The winner gets a title shot. It's seconds away now. You're set to face Bret Hart.
And you think that I'm supposed to be intimidated by the way you build him up and talk about stipulations, don't you? Just don't even say a word, son. Everybody talks about the best there is, the best there was, all the other crap. The excellence of execution. Bret, cliches are cliches, and an ass whipping is an ass whipping, and that's exactly what you're going to get tonight at the hands of Stone Cold Steve Austin, and that's the bottom line.
In just seconds, one of the biggest comebacks in sports entertainment history will happen here at the world's most famous arena, Madison Square Garden. You yourself, Bret, have called Stone Cold Steve Austin the best wrestler in the World Wrestling Federation today, and you face him in seconds.
The one thing that Stone Cold Steve Austin doesn't have going for him in this match is the fact that it is Madison Square Garden. And I meant it when I said it's not a church, but it's holy ground. Well, it is. I've got my fans out here, and I've got my fans all around the world, and they've been waiting for this very moment. Now, where I stand, we're all going to find out right now. But Stone Cold, remember one thing. I'm not greedy for money. I'm greedy for respect, and when this thing's all said and done, you will respect me.
And that leads us to this match between Steve Austin and Bret Hart, a match a lot of people have been anticipating, going back to when Austin was in WCW, and people had, you know, they'd put together their dream cards with WWF and WCW, and always kind of fantasy booking this match, and here it was, Bret Hart making his first match on television since WrestleMania 12. coming back here to Madison Square Garden. Austin comes out, and Jim Ross notes getting to see Austin work at the Dallas Sportatorium, bringing up his world-class days. Hart came out, very strong response here from the New York crowd, and they had a stare down at the beginning. Austin flips off Brett, and then they started off. They started very slow. Hart was working over the left arm, was using the hammer lock. I thought they used this great spot where Austin went for a drop toe hold, and Hart just rolled through the drop toe hold and right back into the hammer lock. It was just such a fluid transition, and it started off really slow but built well with Hart working over the arm. Austin would cut off Hart by dropping him throat first on the top rope. Then Austin would get the heat with a leg sweep, continually going for covers. And at one point, they would work their way to the floor and actually fought through the steel barricade, which was a new spot at the time in terms of fighting into the audience. It wasn't something you saw all the time, and the crowd was just going nuts here for these guys brawling and kind of just picking up the intensity level. From there, Austin slingshot Hart through the Spanish announce table, and this is when Jim Ross asked, "Why is it always the Spanish table that gets broken?" He just kind of played like the CM Punk wise ass at times here on commentary here, but
and yet it hasn't changed.
No, it hasn't. Ross was bringing up past Hart matches in this building against the likes of Mr. Perfect, Owen Hart, really selling the significance of this building and how this match, as it picked up, so did Ross's intensity. And I thought Jim Ross was just like the MVP in this commentary. He really did the heavy lifting, I thought, on commentary. I mean, Vince can really put something over as a spectacle, but it was Ross who was really giving it this special feel to this match, I thought.
Agree, 100%.
They built to the back-and-forth exchange spot with Hart getting the advantage. Crowd was really coming alive here. Hart got hit with the stun gun by Austin onto the top rope, and Austin took the bump off the top rope, and the back of his head landed onto Hart's boot. It looked like a very awkward landing right onto the back of his head. Austin then hit a top rope superplex, went for the stunner, but Hart kicks out. Austin was getting frustrated here at trying to hit Hart with all of his finishes here. It was not working. He went for the Texas Cloverleaf, and it's just funny because you would see guys at this point where the tap out was not established, so you'd see guys selling, and Hart would tap, and you immediately think that it's over, whereas at this point, that really was,
it didn't
the
exist.
Audience wasn't educated to the tap, and it was just, you know, a way to sell as you're tapping the mat, and Hart would eventually make it to the ropes. Another great spot, Hart got... There was an Irish whip into the corner, but he landed ribs first into the steel post under the bottom rope, and they replayed this with this woman yelling when Hart hit the ribs first. Then a bow and arrow spot.
He was always
by
the best
Austin.
At that too, right? Like he was always the best at taking the turnbuckle sternum first.
It was just such a great bump taker, and just being able to sell a body part, it was fantastic in this match. Hart then escaped the bow and arrow, and he tries for the sharpshooter, but Austin reaches the ropes before it's applied. Austin then counters a sleeper with a jawbreaker, and this leads to Austin going for the million-dollar dream, and then Hart runs up the ropes, lands on top. This is right out of the finish from WrestleMania 8 with Piper, and he pins Austin, basically using his own momentum against him. 28 minutes, 36 seconds these two go. I thought this was a fantastic match. It was a perfect example of a guy getting over with a loss, and you even had like the little subtle stories of Hart not being able to beat him with the sharpshooter that leaves you open for a rematch. Austin lasted here with Brett, and I thought it helped both guys. Phenomenal match.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was the impetus of the whole pay-per-view, right? The promos and the match itself. They had me at the stare down, really. I mean, as soon as they stared down right at the beginning, and JR, I think he said something like, if you enjoyed Holyfield Tyson, you'll enjoy this. I think it was the fight that he referenced. But anyway, it just put so much importance. And this is fantastic. I mean, Brett, like you said, Brett has so many great matches in MSG. Like, two of my favorite matches are him and Perfect and him and Owen at WrestleMania 10. And this one, it ranks right up there. It was awesome.
And it was just such a simple build. It was like Hart came back, he did his promo saying he re-signed, and he wants to face the best wrestler in the company, Steve Austin, which
is not Shawn Michaels, by the way, if you noticed.
Exactly. It was great, because it's like the seeds for a rematch with Michaels by knocking him there, and it was like a simple promo where Austin had called him out for all those weeks, and it was the whole promos were the legend returns. It's like a dream match, and you didn't have to do any crazy angles or stupid stipulations. It's just a match presented, and people responded to it. It was simple, and people dug it.
I love, I always pay attention to the little things, you know, I like that kind of stuff. And I like the Bret Hart's pile driver in this match versus Mankind's pile driver on Taker. I just love the little differences, like Bret Hart, like technically, like he'll pick him up and he'll jump in the air and it just looks very fluid. Whereas Mankind will just grab you by the pants and just sit down on you. Like, I just like those little subtle differences, and it both moves match the character, which I just think, I just love that high level of thinking like that.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's something that's really lost on some guys who just, as we talked about, similar with promos, with guys saying, you know, conducting promos as their character. It's similar very much to your body language. It's no different in terms of how you would execute a move. Mankind should not be a guy doing polished moves. It would not fit his character as this nut. Anyway, we move on. A fantastic match.
So how do you follow this up, John?
Ooh, how not? How could you not follow this up with something great than another elimination match? Before we went to this, they did go to a replay here after the Austin Brett match, and they did like the split screen into the replay, and they had the In Your House logo on the screen as they flipped it. And I was like, oops. Oh, Kevin Dunn, you fucked up.
Oh.
Doc Hendricks is backstage with Psycho Sid.
Now, this is what I was mentioning. He's like, yeah, this is how you follow up this dream, this awesome five-star match.
Wearing his backwards baseball hat, which for longtime wrestling fans was a nice little subtle reference to Sid and his love of softball.
Yep.
Doc Hendricks asks him, are you going to snap tonight? I love Sid promos. Sid always had a special place in my heart because when I was 12, I used to love this guy. He did his classic high-low delivery, where I'm going to talk like this. It just up and down in his promos, much like Shawn Michaels would do. Always drove me nuts about these two, how their volume would go up and down.
His response is a perfect example. You say snap. I say survive!
Sid was great. I love Sid. Then Captain Lou Albano comes out. They announced that he was inducted into the WWF Hall of Fame the prior night. And Jim Ross notes, do you know he has a book out? He only mentioned it about 40 times last night, which seems like exactly what Lou Albano would do. Did you ever get to interview Lou Albano?
No.
I never did.
I read a funny story about him in that book that came out, The 101 Strangest Matches in Pro Wrestling.
Yep.
He was managing Don Morocco, and it was a squash match. And he brought a meatball sandwich and a Coke to the ring. And in between moves, Morocco would stop, go eat a bite of the sandwich, and then come back and do another move. And he was getting ready for the pile driver, and he actually dragged whoever, I don't even know who it was, but he dragged him to Albano so he could eat as he's still set up in the pile driver. He takes a bite of the sandwich, then delivers the pile driver. I'm like, man, you know what? One of my indie guys should take that. That's a good idea.
The eating gimmick.
Yeah.
So Lou Albano comes down, shakes Jim Ross's hand, goes to shake McMahon's hand, and then pulls his hand away. And Ross just makes fun of him, saying, you didn't see that coming. You didn't see that coming. Vince and Albano always had issues where McMahon and them, they wouldn't get along, and McMahon would like fire him and then bring him back. And anyway, Albano joined the Spanish announce team, which at this point I wanted to hear the commentary.
Of course, yeah.
Albano here with whoever it was, Hugo Savinovich and Carlos Cabrera.
Yeah. Wow, we're nerds. It's awesome.
That is what we are, Arda. And then we move on to, this was a match that had to be on the show. We had Farouk complete with the full Nation of Domination with PG-13 and his entire entourage.
Don't diss the man or we'll bum rush your mother. The best rap ever, man.
I enjoyed that gimmick when it first came out.
Farouk is the man, so hit your knees and start praying.
What was the line about, it's like, something about a count and then... like the three count in the ring. They worked it into like a three
Clarence
count.
Clarence Mason is the boss. Cross the T's and dot and I's. No, that's before that.
Cross the T's and dot the I's.
He tells the truth, the whole truth, and never tells. I wonder if Clarence Mason is part of Christian's legal team.
I never knew. It was. I remember hearing that someone did an interview with him where it was like the guy was like a legit lawyer before.
It's awesome.
And that's how they found him to play that role. Farouk is teaming up with the fake Razor Ramon, Titan. Along with the fake Diesel, Glenn Jacobs, and Vader to take on Savio Vega, a gigantic Yokozuna, Flash Funk, who was he making his debut on the show?
I think so.
Because Jim Cornette was on commentary here and had no idea who Flash Funk was. And then they introduced their mystery team member, Jimmy Snuka.
Yeah.
Who was a legend in 96 and 15 years later is still doing dates.
He's still doing appearances. Yep.
Oh. Unfortunate. I always remember when I was 15 years old going to a an indie show at Medieval Times in the summer of 99 where Scott D'Amore worked Tatanka.
Of course.
And Jimmy Snuka, I went and I volunteered to help with the ring crew. And Jimmy Snuka got there in the afternoon, and I remember going up to him as, like, you know, 14, 15-year-old kid, and I asked for his autograph. He's like, oh, brother, give me an hour. I'm going to give you your autograph. And then later when I asked him for it, he's like, oh, whatever you need, brother, $2. It's like, oh, man, just the moment
$2.
The wrestling love died. It was like, $2? Sure, here's $2, Jimmy. I don't need the autograph. Such a sad day for a wrestling fan.
The day the bubble bursts, eh?
No, that was it. Jim Cornette joined the commentary here with McMahon and Ross. He could not understand Flash Funk's gimmick here, where he was a subtle pimp.
Yes.
This was the precursor to The Godfather.
Well, I did like JR's line saying, I've never seen the yellow and red look so good in the garden.
Oh, fuck. Man, you got some gems here I missed. Holy shit.
You re-bust that one out. I was
what
like, whoa.
What an awesome line.
Look for man. Flash Funk.
Oh, I've got to listen to this stuff closer, man. Fuck, what a great line Ross got out there.
Although we
got
to say Snuka was over, though.
Oh, he got a huge pop here. Absolutely. In New York, no less. Funk, early on, hits a moonsault to the floor onto Vader. A great cushion for you. And then they're back in the ring. Vader hits him with a powerbomb. Yokozuna gets in, attempted, like, a uranage, and was just so big at this point. Like, this was right around the time that, like, New York and a number of other states wouldn't even license this guy to compete.
Yeah.
And that's why he disappeared and never popped up in WCW or anywhere. Just huge at this point. Snuka got in with the fake diesel. Was actually going, like, 50-50 with Vader, which was kind of odd. It's like Vader goes from, like, main eventing SummerSlam to here he is selling for, you know, an aging Jimmy Snuka. But the crowd was into Snuka, as Arda noted. And even slams Vader at one point. The rope gets pulled down. Vader Vega goes to the floor, and he is sent ribs first into the post. Farouk then comes back into the ring. Diesel then goes for a power bomb, and is it Diesel that gets eliminated here? I believe my notes are all fucked up here. Snuka then goes for a splash.
You paid more attention during this match than I did, just so you know.
I wasn't paying attention to the commentary. I missed the high spot of the match with Jim Ross. Snuka then goes for a splash off the top rope, the spot that everyone wants to see, eliminates Ramon. Then Diesel comes back into the ring with a chair, starts attacking people, delivers an unprotected chair shot to Snuka.
Uh-huh.
Snuka's the one that takes the chair shot to the head. Vega then comes back with a chair. Looked like they were building to a future IWA Puerto Rico program here.
Thank God.
And the match is ruled a draw due to a double disqualification at 9:45. So are you telling me no one could job in this match?
Nope, not one person.
This was like just an excuse to get Snuka out there and do his spot.
It's an excuse for everyone to take a piss.
That was it. So there we go. That was the time filler. And you got Jimmy Snuka for the nostalgia pop. Got the promo for the main event. Sid is shown walking backstage. He enters the ring. He got the big Sid pyro here. And then Jim Ross notes here, Sid, suddenly I'm dominant. And this was filed under nicknames that did not catch on.
Yes.
Suddenly I'm dominant. Michaels comes out with Jose Lothario. He gets flowers from a fan. And then another fan, she grabs him. And security actually has to come here and pry this woman off of Sean. This was a very, very interesting match to watch and really translates well to today's product and John Cena. And it's amazing how much more of a professional John Cena is than Shawn Michaels was at this point. Shawn Michaels walking into Madison Square Garden here. He was like the ultra babyface at this point, defending against Psycho Sid. And for whatever reason, the Northeast crowd has always kind of gotten behind Sid. I've always noticed, like, they've always been, you know, a fan of Sid, and it goes for the New York crowd for a lot of heels, like the cool heel that they've got behind.
I just feel like, for all of the faults and everything that we can say about Sid, you know, we joked about half the brain and we're live pal last week, but like in this match
he was great.
He was, and I don't think it was just because he was facing Shawn Michaels. I honestly think that he did carry a little bit of his load in this match.
Well, I thought, you know, Sean's fantastic. I'm never going to criticize the guy as a performer, but when this crowd started booing him, he got his pouty face on and was just like a baby throughout this. Whereas Cena, you can tell the guy, he doesn't care what reaction he gets. Guy works hard. He's not going to, you know, get his crybaby face on. And the same can go with Rock when he would go through that. With Lesnar in Long Island, where they booed him out of it. And it was like Sean was just, it really came through of just how much of a prima donna he was at this point, because he really let this crowd rattle him at times. And the match starts off, and Michaels is just bumping around for Sid here to start, which was, I thought, a smart way to go. Sid teased the powerbomb really early on, but Michaels escapes to the floor, comes back in, and then clips the knee of Sid. And this is when the crowd started to boo Michaels, and Michaels just gives them this weird look of, what's wrong with you? And then we began chants of Psycho Sid. They were definitely rattling Michaels, and he goes for this figure four spot, and as he twists around, he actually yells, fuck you, at the crowd. It's like, you're only like throwing a match onto the gasoline with this at this point, and the crowd just, the commentary team even had to acknowledge the crowd split here. And Michaels gets sent into the barricade off the apron. The fans are cheering for them. They're all getting behind Sid here. And we moved on. Michaels was Irish whipped into the corner, fought off Sid on the apron as the crowd was booing off the top. And Michaels comes off, gets caught by Sid. Crowd is just, Sid could do so little here and get such a big reaction, which was fantastic. Michaels, they play up that he's out on his feet taking these punches, and God bless Sid, but his punches were just Rob Van Dam level at times.
The punches at the beginning of the match were good, where Sean took four bumps in 15 seconds, but yeah, they deteriorated from there.
Michaels took this awesome bump off the second rope, where he went into a boot of Sid, and it was like he did almost like a Ted DiBiase bump onto like the top of his head and flipped over. Incredible bump. Then Sid goes for the $1 million dream. And Ross identifies this as the move Austin used earlier on. And I think this was they were TNA agents working this.
Uh-huh.
Sid then blocks the sweet chin music, hits a choke slam. Crowd was just going ape shit here for Sid. Michaels then counters a powerbomb attempt, goes for a small package, gets a two count. And then Michaels, this was great, he does a kip up, and immediately Sid just knocks him down with a lariat. Great spot. It was just like booking to Sid's strengths was the key in this match, I thought. And then this is when Sid grabs the camera. Jose Lothario gets onto the apron, and he hits Lothario right into the chest. And then Michaels hits the sweet chin music. Crowd is booing, and Lothario is on the ground selling his chest. Michaels goes to check on him and is yelling to the back for people to come help. He drops an F-bomb here. Michaels then comes back into the ring. He comes off the second rope, and he hits Earl Hebner with a crossbody as Sid ducks. He goes back to checking on Lothario as Sid comes from behind. He hits Michaels with the same camera. Ross then says, I hope Jose Lothario is not having a heart attack. And he does it in the most serious voice. It was like, do we have to go to that extreme here? And Sid then hits Michaels with the powerbomb after the camera shot, pins Michaels, gets a gigantic pop. Yep. The guy who might have killed this old man gets the big pop in New York.
Huge.
They went just about 20 minutes here, and Sid is your new WWF champion. And what was interesting here, first of all, Michaels went back. He almost like no-sold the powerbomb. He immediately gets up and goes to check on Lothario right after the match, kind of negating the finish to me, but whatever. And then Sid, after the match, is on the ground, and he's like fist-pumping with the fans, like with acting as your big baby face here.
He even got a hug from Vladimir.
Vladimir the super fan.
And so like he's laughing too. He's laughing. He's like, Vladimir, you little kid, are you?
Did you ever see the time that Vladimir got used on a garden show with Piper?
No.
He actually brought Vladimir into the ring.
Wow.
And he got to talk on the mic with Piper. It was like some mid-80s garden show.
I'd love to talk to that. Like, I saw him.
I've tried.
Really?
He's like my Haku. I've tried to find that guy, and it's just, I cannot find that.
Can't find Vladimir.
And the Cactus Jack fan.
Yeah, they're hard, eh?
Who was in the crowd as well, the Cactus Jack fan.
They're hard
fan.
To find. Ah, too bad.
Vladimir would be
amazing. I'd love that interview.
It's like, for as we said, we are wrestling nerds, and that to me would be, I'd love to talk
he did
to
have
that
a
guy.
He did have an article in WWF magazine in like 97.
Did he? Really?
They did put a picture of him, and he's like, this guy's at front row at every show. He looks like Where's Waldo, a jacked up Where's Waldo. Like, people, if you're listening to this and you don't know, like, you probably have seen him before if you've watched old school.
Oh, guaranteed. Like, he's someone that is just so familiar. But you know what would be interesting to talk to him about? When is the last time you've seen it? It's like he sounds like he's a disenfranchised wrestling fan. I can't remember seeing this guy in the last decade at a wrestling show. And it's like, if that guy got turned off, it's like, that's an amazing statement right there. So that was the Survivor Series, everyone. A much better show than the last two. I gave this one a 7.5 out of 10. Austin and Brett was awesome. The crowd heat for the main event was really good, and per Sid standards, a good match. The opener I thought was great with Furnace and LaFon. Very little to complain about on this show. They tried to make a number of guys from Maivia to LaFon and Furnace, Austin. It was really interesting. This is when they were getting murdered by WCW. The NWO had just taken off, and when you're in a desperate situation, you're forced to make changes, and that's what this period was like for the company.
No, I agree. I think it was a very strong show, and I liked the booking. You had the Furnace and LaFon carrying a technical opener, then you had a brawl with Taker Mankind, then you had another Survivor Series match, then you had Bret and Austin, which is like the match everyone looked forward to, then you had a little bit of a lull with the Survivor Series match, then you had your main event. So it was a very well-flowing, good, like well-booked show from start to finish.
Art O'Cal is a busy, busy man, so we're going to cut things off here. I'm going to come back in just a few minutes with all of the feedback. But before we go, Arta, give us a plug. Aftermath, the rechristened Raw Radio, is up this Monday. Tell us about where listeners can go check it out on Monday.
Yeah, it'll be thescore.com/radio. You'll be able to live stream it, and you can check it out on iTunes and, yeah, I guess follow on Twitter, ARDA_OCAL. And thank you very much for having me for the last 3 weeks. And whenever Way's not here, I'm here, buddy.
Awesome.
I have claimed my backup spot.
This might be the end of the 3 weeks, but we definitely want to have you back.
Sweet.
Tons of, you're more popular than me amongst our crowd, so we'll
whatever,
definitely have you back.
Someone made us a poster. Did you see that, by the way?
Two posters. Where Art Way?
Yeah.
And the Survivor Series one? Yeah. I look retarded in all of them. So go check that out. That was from our Photoshop wizard, Ahmad Buttons. So thank you very much for that. So I'll be back with the feedback. Thanks again. Follow Arta, Arta_Ocal, and check out Aftermath Radio with Arta and Jimmy Corderas.
I hope Jose, my God, I hope he's not having a heart attack. I hope he's not having a heart attack. I mean, that's a bigger story than a WWF title. I'm sorry.
And Shawn Michaels thrown back into the ring.
Shawn Michaels struck in the back of the head by the camera.
And Sid with an opportunity here to finish it. Sid just may finish it.
If Sid hits it, it's over. We got a new champion.
All right, so once again, a big thank you to Art O'Cal for joining us. So we'll now get into everyone's feedback here that I'm going to go through. So we'll start off with Tom Ketwig, the 10th anniversary show. I can't wait to watch the show on the second Survivor Series anthology. The Bret Hart versus Steve Austin match, which was on the last Steve Austin WWE release, is really good. I can't believe this was the debut, at least on pay-per-view, of The Rock, along with Flash Funk, a.k.a. Too Cold Scorpio. I believe the Sid versus Shawn Michaels match was the match where Sid was cheered and Michaels was booed, yes, and in fact, that was the same match. Thulani Mabuza N-Cube. I'm surprised at how little of this pay-per-view I actually recall. The only thing that stood out for me was the babyface reaction Sid got from the crowd. I could never tell whether it was because fans were fed up with the vanilla babyface Shawn or whether Sid was just that much over with the crowd. In fact, over a year before at WrestleMania 11, even though he wasn't involved in the match, Psycho Sid got a bigger pop than Michaels and Diesel during their WWF title match. The rest of the card was below average, with the exception of the Taker-Mankind match that I enjoyed. And fuck,
Buck, the fake Razor and Diesel. Is this show where Dwayne Johnson debuted? Anyway, thanks for the great show and keep up the great work. P.S. Will Way ever get his spot back? Yes, Way will be back, everyone. Next week, he is returning. And that was always the deal with Sid, was that in the Northeast specifically, it was always an area of the country that, much like we see today, where they will get behind certain heels, they always were into Sid. And if you'll remember, this show taking place in New York City, the WrestleMania that Thulani mentioned was in Hartford. It was just always a territory where Sid got over really big, and this night was perfect. And I think the Michaels babyface persona was somewhat to do with that, and the New York City crowd was not taken to it. Blaine Vandergreen, Austin versus Brett stole the show. I may be in the minority here, but I actually thought this was better than their WrestleMania match. The last elimination match was such an obvious time filler and completely unnecessary. Having said that, I thought the other elimination matches were pretty good. The Taker versus Mankind match was okay, but the problem was they didn't deliver what was supposed to happen as a result of the finish. Taker was supposed to get his hands on Paul Bearer, which didn't happen thanks to the Executioner, not Buddy Rose. And therefore, the stipulation was kind of pointless. The main event was probably the best match that Sid has ever had, but the heel turn kind of came out of nowhere. The heel turn came out of nowhere. I don't know who he's referring to here, because if anything, it was Sid acting like a babyface at the end of that match. Alexander Rios. Wow, one of my favorite pay-per-views of all time. It was around this time, too, in late 96, where I started watching wrestling again after taking a break in 93. To me, this show, looking back on it, might be the beginning precursor to the Attitude Era, where you knew the stink of the new generation was starting to wear off with Stone Cold running roughshod in his promos leading up to the return of Bret Hart. Granted, this show in no means was an all-time five-star classic. Marty Jannetty was probably on attempted comeback number six here. Davey Boy Smith would have to be my nominee for the Putski for sure. If you think the announced teams of today were dysfunctional, look at this show. Vince McMahon, Jim Ross, Jerry Lawler, Jim Cornette, and Sonny as well. Jimmy Snuka in 96. My God, enough said. Anyway, on to the positives, which we saw another solid Undertaker-Mankind match, and this was probably the rivalry that brought me back to begin with. Austin Brett really brought it, in my opinion, setting up for the grand finale at WrestleMania 13, and finally the debut of one Rocky Maivia, better known today as The Rock. While watching as it is now, sure it's a bit of a mark-out moment, but in early 97, was anyone saying future Hall of Famer? Were they even saying low mid-carder? Nope, they were all chanting Rocky sucks. It was interesting. I think everyone saw Rocky Maivia, just the way he was introduced. I mean, this guy was by no means a flop. He looked really good in his debut. The company was clearly behind him, that I think a lot of people saw him as kind of in that next mold as your kind of top babyface, but I don't think anyone would have imagined him getting over the way he did. It was quite the contrast seeing him in that debut, but there were people right from the beginning that pegged this guy to be a top star within the WWE. I mean, a lot of people had high hopes for this guy. On to Roger Langford. Loved this pay-per-view at the time. The intro, the entrance, and the sponsor Milton Bradley Karate Fighters were all awesome. For me, the lasting memory is Austin's entrance to the ring. He felt like a legit badass coming to kick the shit out of the returning hero Bret Hart. The title match also had so much drama to it. 8 out of 10 from me. We move over to Dashing Evan Harden. Survivor Series was a stellar card. I love seeing the fake Diesel and Razor Ramon, and this was also the debut of the great one, The Rock. Match of the night goes to Stone Cold and Bret Hart. These two had such awesome chemistry in the ring. Also, the Shawn Michaels Psycho Sid match was bizarre because you had Shawn Michaels, who was a babyface, who got booed, and then you had Sid, who the crowd loved that night, and it made for some bizarre moments. By the way, did Jose Lothario really have a heart attack that night? The one spot where Sid hit Lothario in the chest with the camera made it hard for me to watch. Just wondering if this was planned or not, because if it wasn't, Lothario did a beautiful job of selling. Well, you can tip your cap to Jose Lothario, who was not having a heart attack on pay-per-view. Jeff Cook, this pay-per-view had a who's who of faces from the late 90s, full of debuts, returns, and classics. Well, classic. It even had Razor and Diesel 2.0. Owen was superb as usual. Maybe the one man, in my opinion, that could actually get an enjoyable match out of Furnace and LaFawn. Well, I think you're really undercutting Doug Furnace and Phil LaFawn, who were tremendous workers. I even think this was the first of Taker's super entrances coming down like a bat. I think the Mankind-Taker feud may have been one of the best for both men. Why the hell was Wyndham there? I had totally forgot about the stalker gimmick, but I think this was soon before the new Blackjacks formed. Much like everyone else will point out, the match of the night had to go to Austin and Hart. Just an awesome technical brawl. Those two made their heat so believable. Hard to think that both were friends and had high respect for each other. I can remember marking out to the Piper WrestleMania finish. Yes, even as a kid, I knew that was the finish. I remember just being pissed about Michaels losing to Sid. Back then, I remember being a little worried for Jose when Sid hit him. But now that I'm a smarter fan, I realize it just looked horrible. I still laugh at Sean crawling up the aisle after Jose. All in all, it was an alright show, good for nostalgia. I give it a 7 out of 10, mostly for the Austin Hart match. Makes you kind of miss all the actual SummerSlam elimination matches. You should have done 95 or keep them in mind for... You should have done Survivor Series 95 or keep in mind for another review. You know, to be honest, I've never been a giant fan of the Survivor Series elimination matches. I've always found that you're trying to work in so many finishes into an allotted time period that you really don't have that time to tell a great story with all these people outside of the obvious one where maybe it is a babyface trying to overcome the odds against, three or four heels. But to me, it was... I was never a gigantic fan of them. I've seen some unbelievable matches in these. I always go back to the 2003 Survivor Series where it was Team Austin against Team Bischoff. And it was that's probably my favorite Survivor Series elimination match I've ever seen. Just a fantastic match. And Shawn Michaels was just on another planet that night in terms of work. Anyway, we move on to David Banks. There's something special about a WWE event at Madison Square Garden. The build-up for months between Austin and Hart was gold. Austin talking shit about Hart, just trying to talk him back into the ring. Going on every show from Raw to Livewire, just shooting down Hart until he came back to face Austin. Austin was without a doubt the breakout star of 96, and this match was the match of the night. The stare-down between the two was a moment. The camera was shaking. Then came the double bird, which was really summed up the whole feud. The match told a great story, and even though Austin lost, you knew the feud was going to have another chapter. This was the first event where you got to see Rocky Maivia. Seeing The Rock coming out smiling from ear to ear in the curly top was funny, but everyone started out with a funny gimmick. With the crowd booing Shawn Michaels, it was surprising, but that's the New York crowd. They know who they like and who they don't. Overall, this event was a good one, with the crowd making it even better. I agree. The crowd did make for a fun main event, which you didn't get to see too often at that time in the WWF in terms of a major show kind of atmosphere. Aram Nasrallah, my favorite Survivor Series of all time. Austin Hart ending was awesome. Surprises like Jimmy Snuka and Jake the Snake, crowd turning on HBK, this was an awesome show. Actually, the only thing I remember that I didn't like was them pushing Rocky Maivia as the sole survivor. Ryan Daniels, a good event and a fine choice for review. How sad that this was the final WWF pay-per-view appearance of Yokozuna. Perhaps it was for the best, as he was nowhere in the shape he was in 93, nor did he seem to have the same mobility anymore. Also, remember this as the debut of Taker's new look, without the purple gloves and leg stockings, with the tear painted on his face. It was also fascinated with the Jose Lothario situation with Sid and the camera at ringside, leading to Sid winning the WWF title. This was a big focal point leading up to the Rumble 97 rematch, also featuring Jose's son sitting front row ringside and Sean making use of a camera as retribution on Sid. That may be a good event to look at sometime. Royal Rumble 97. That's right. They used Pete Lothario, as I do recall, during that match. And that was really the impetus for this whole thing, was that the company booked the Alamo Dome for the Royal Rumble a few months later, and the idea of Shawn Michaels defending the title at that show really wasn't the draw as much as Shawn chasing the title that he had, you know, wrongfully lost. So that was their idea, to get the title on Sid for a quick run with the belt, and then Shawn won it back at the Royal Rumble. But the Alamo Dome was... they actually got a ton of people into that arena. It held like over 40,000 people, and I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but there was a lot of paper at that show, and they also did a smart idea where tickets were dirt cheap for that show as well, so you were able to fill it up a lot more. But that was kind of the idea at the time, with Shawn chasing for the title would draw more people in for that Royal Rumble. We go on to Atish Singh. First off, I want to apologize to John for requesting SummerSlam 89 a few weeks ago. It was a nostalgic show for me, and I wanted to see your guys' opinion of it. Survivor Series 96 was a pretty decent show. The Rock's debut was a highlight, especially to see how he morphed into the People's Champion in the years to come. Brett vs. Austin was awesome and really put Austin on the map as a main eventer, changing in there with the Hitman. Love the finish from the WrestleMania 8 match versus Piper. Really shows Brett's superb in-ring psychology. Sad to think this was his comeback match and would leave the company the next year in Montreal. Yeah, very true. Bret Hart always synonymous with Survivor Series and not this Survivor Series. But as I said with Arda, it was a fantastic finish, and I really loved how they chose to do that versus the sharpshooter finish, and it led something that, you know, Brett couldn't beat him with the sharpshooter and had to go for an alternate. Whenever you can tell stories with moves and physicality, that's when you can really get deep with stuff and really tell a story in the ring, which is what the entire industry is centered around. It was a fantastic match. We move on to, and you do not have to apologize, anyone, for any stuff you review. I mean, at the end of the day, we're watching wrestling here. It's not the worst punishment in the world. Alex R. Stephanie. After watching this, I was reminded of the Punk versus Cena angle. This could have been Brett versus Austin 2.0. This feud carried the company for a full year, even with Brett not wrestling for 8 months. WWE took the time to properly build this. Brett equals Cena, babyface loved by millions, marked for the kids. Austin equals Punk, unappreciated worker, hungry for success and respect. They could have done the double turn at Money in the Bank or waited for another pay-per-view. This company didn't need to pop a buy rate at SummerSlam. Which shows us this company is more like WCW, only caring about buy rates and ratings instead of building feuds to make money. I shake my head thinking that the WWE could have done this exact same angle, but blew it just to pop a buy rate. Well, we've been over the Cena heel turn many times, and, you know, as much as people, I think it would be very refreshing to see John Cena in a completely different role. You know, if we're talking about making money, I would say it's a bad money decision to flip John Cena over into the heel role. And as much as people want to nag on John Cena, you know, he is not. WWE pay-per-views as a whole are significantly down, and it's very hard to draw right now on pay-per-view for this company, and I don't put that on the shoulders of John Cena. It's a larger issue than John Cena. But in terms, it's really interesting when you look at the breakdowns every week, you know, in like the Wrestling Observer newsletter of who moves numbers every week on television, and I'm always fascinated by that aspect of it, and, you know, the quarter-hour breakdowns, and it's like, John Cena is a pretty consistent television draw, and when he is on TV, people tune in. And I think, you know, a lot of people will rag on John Cena, but there's a giant segment of the audience that looks at this guy as he is professional wrestling to them. And I think that at this point, John Cena turning heel, it might be interesting, but I think that would also be, you know, who knows, 4 months in, are people going to be tired of Cena? I really feel the same people that complain about John Cena today would be eventually complaining about him as a heel. And that's just, I would not be making the decision right now to turn John Cena heel myself. Mainly because right now you don't have a top babyface to take that role from him. CM Punk, to me, he's a babyface to a segment of the audience, but he is not the top babyface, in my opinion, for the entire company in terms of marketing to the children and someone that can fill that role for John Cena. And that was one of the big issues when they turned Steve Austin, was that Rock was leaving at the time to go do the Scorpion King movie, and you had no top babyface to take Austin's role. And they got their feet wet with Benoit and Jericho, but never went the whole way with them. Undertaker and Kane were not designed to be top babyfaces at the time in terms of the number one role of the babyface in the company, and there was no one to take that spot. Hunter didn't want to come back as a babyface, or at least at the time he was injured at that point. And oh, I'm getting all my stuff mixed up right now. It was Hunter who remained heel when he was perfectly aligned at that time to flip babyface and feud with Austin, and instead they kept Hunter a heel. So there was no one really in that role after Austin turned, and that to me was a big error on the company's part 10 years ago. Anyway, I digress. Let's move on here. We'll go to Steve Kassan. Back in 96, I love Psycho Sid. His look, his demeanor, his music, his entire gimmick here. And when he came out through the entrance at Madison Square Garden, you get the feeling, or I did, that this guy is the man. Add to that the pyro of his name at the entrance, which they should go back to. I find this pay-per-view interesting because you see the transition from early 90s performers going into the Attitude Era. Looking back now, it's fascinating on company directions with pay-per-views like this. Fake Razor and Diesel, love to know your thoughts. I know it was a stupid thing to do, but your discussions with the Super Clash reviews are fantastic. Let's give it up for Brother Clarence Mason. I would like to induct Brother Clarence to the Law Brotherhood Woodcrest Rags to Bitches section. All right, Steve. I hated the fake Razor Ramon, fake Diesel gimmick. I'm just happy that it didn't destroy the careers of Glenn Jacobs or Rick Titan, who, you know, he had his run in FMW, didn't really do much over here in North America, but I thought it was really lame. It was a complete type of bait and switch angle where they promised that next week Razor Ramon and Diesel will be here. And the funniest story coming out of that was just Jim Ross did one of the roundtable shows for Classics on Demand recently and talked about a story that Kevin Nash had told him where, for whatever reason, Nash and Hall had not sign their contracts or an extension of or whatnot by that fall of 96. And when Jim Ross announced that on Raw, WCW panicked and actually paid Hall and Nash more money than they had originally promised them with the fear that they were going to be on Raw the following week. So Nash and Hall actually made money off of the angle the WWF shot for the fake Diesel and fake Razor Ramon. And in terms of a concept, I thought it was pretty lame. And what was more lame was that they kept these guys around. And I thought it only brought attention that the real guys that played these roles have left our company and we don't have them anymore. And these two characters just reminded you of that, where, you know, I want to see the originals and they're on the other show. I actually thought it was a completely counterproductive angle by the company and was not a fan of it at the time. Yeah, even as a 12-year-old, I was a cynic. We move on to Patrick McCarley. The best part of Survivor Series 96 was the match between Bret Hart and Steve Austin. Fans at the time will remember that Bret had taken a sabbatical after WrestleMania 12. In the months before Bret's return, Austin, hot off his King of the Ring win, repeatedly challenged the Hitman. This match proves that you can lose cleanly, yet still come out looking better than you did before. True, Bret basically reused the Mania 8 finish, but it played into the match well, since JR had been prophesizing that it would end with a submission. The show was also the zenith of Sid's career. He was really over with the MSG crowd, probably more over than WWE wanted him to be. Still, the show may be best known for the debut of The Rock, aka Rocky Maivia, who debuted with a look and gimmick that is much different than what he would become known for. There were definitely low points to the show, like Razor Ramon and Diesel, but overall, the good outweighs the bad. Overall, I'd rate it 7 out of 10. Let's move on to Kevin Waters. I was a huge Bret Hart fan, so I was upset at the WrestleMania 12 end and Steve cutting those promos on Bret all summer, calling him a crybaby and putting S in front of Hitman, and you got what I think of Bret Hart. So I was really looking forward to this match, and it delivered. 28-minute clinic. No one is better than Bret between those ropes. Maybe equals, but not better. I really feel this feud is what propelled Austin to the top and the main event of WrestleMania 14. I like to think this was the beginning of the Attitude Era. It started that summer at King of the Ring, and this feud with Bret. Even the finish with the Million Dollar Dream with Steve just coming off the Ringmaster gimmick with DiBiase had meaning. Great match. Go to Rick Bergman. I think of this pay-per-view as the beginning of a short era in the WWEF between Survivor Series and WrestleMania 13, in which they were transitioning between the standard model of wrestling with heels and babyfaces and the soon-to-be Attitude Era. This period is often criticized by others, I think in large part due to the way it ended at WrestleMania 13 with a subpar match between Sid and The Undertaker. Despite that, I love this era. I loved how there were several superstars at the time that you could legitimately believe could be world champion at any time. Vader, Mankind, Undertaker, Bret Hart, Steve Austin, Yokozuna, Sid, and Shawn Michaels. In fact, at the time, I often wondered why they wasted away a lot of talent by letting Michaels have the belt and was thrilled when Sid beat him. They had a lot of real good next level up-and-coming talent as well, with Triple H, The Rock, Farouk, and Bradshaw, just to name a few. As for the pay-per-view itself, I thought it was a good launching match for what would take place the next couple of months. The Austin Hart match was great and led to a rivalry that would last nearly an entire year, which is difficult even for 96-97. The pay-per-view was loaded with talent and made up some of the cheesy gimmicks, like Razor Ramon and Diesel too. It was very unique how Sid and Stone Cold, two heels, got the biggest pop from the crowd. There were some weird things that took place too during this period, one of which was Michaels taking the belt at the Royal Rumble, only to drop it a few weeks later. However, I like what it leads to, a more or less fatal four-way battle royal, which Bret Hart won. Even better, I felt it led to my all-time favorite Raw, where Stone Cold came out and nailed Hart with the chair to cost him the world title. In conclusion, I give this pay-per-view an 8, mainly because it helped launch what I feel, and I know I'm probably in the minority, one of my favorite periods in the WWE. I love the show. Keep up the great work. All right, well, thanks very much for those kind words. And this was definitely a period where there was lots of issues going on behind the scenes with Bret and Shawn and that whole deal where Michaels won the belt at the Royal Rumble, winning it back from Sid. It was supposed to set up him losing the title to Bret at WrestleMania 13. That was the original plan, and that's when the mysterious knee injury occurred to Shawn Michaels and led to the Lost My Smile speech on that Thursday Raw. And vacated the title, and that's where it ended up. It ended up back on Undertaker when all was said and done after being on Bret for one night. But that was the plan. They ended up having to hotshot that title a number of times over a six-month period, which I'm never a big fan of, but that was the issue right there. They were building up to Shawn, Bret in a rematch at WrestleMania 13 where Bret would get his win back over Shawn, and of course it never happened. Well, they would have their rematch and a little match at Survivor Series 97. Dean Kasulis, who would have thought that guy in the dorky outfit in the throwaway four-on-four match would end up being one of the greatest stars in wrestling history? This was the first Survivor Series where it felt there was more of a focus on one-on-one matches than there was for the Survivor matches. Austin versus Bret was a classic, and the Austin promos leading up to the match are among my favorite of all time. Undertaker descending from the roof with the bat wings was iconic for its time, and Sid getting a huge babyface pop versus Michaels was groundbreaking for its time. As a Michaels mark my entire life, I was so upset to see the crowd turn on Shawn, and even more upset when Sid won the title by cheating. Overall, a good pay-per-view in a weird period for the WWF when it was slowly stepping away from the cartoon circus of the 90s and inching closer to the Attitude Era. It was certainly a transitional period for the company, where, as we mentioned, it was they were getting their asses kicked at this point by WCW, who were just white hot at this time and only going to get hotter in 97. But you know what? The company, they got their stuff in order, and 1997 was probably the most important year for the WWF because, yes, they hit rock bottom in a financial sense, but at the same time, you were watching Raw every week, and that was a compelling show in 97 where you could watch that show each week and you knew there was a momentum change, that it was going to come at some point, and it sort of germinated in late 96, early 97, and then was actualized in, you know, WrestleMania 14 and that spring of 98, where the company just exploded at that point. And, you know, everyone will point to Mike Tyson being a turning point. I look at Mike Tyson as the guy that it was like the WWF throughout 97. They laid all the wood down, all of the kindling. They put together this bonfire and they doused it with gasoline, and Mike Tyson was the spark. And that to me is a horrible analogy, but that was kind of what I looked at it as. Mike Tyson was just the last ingredient needed to push them over the top, and that product was so strong that when Mike Tyson was gone the next night after WrestleMania 14, the casual fans that came in stuck with that product because they were compelled with what they saw at that WrestleMania and with the television leading up to WrestleMania. Two more here. Andrew Hickey. I would definitely support having TNA and Arda become regulars on Review Away. Enjoyed last week's show. I actually didn't see Survivor Series 96 when it first happened, as access to wrestling was limited in Cyprus where I was living. I didn't see it until 98, and it was interesting to watch the company make its transition from family to adult content. The Austin and Mankind characters were worlds away from the cartoonish Flash Funk and Rocky Maivia. The MSG crowd and atmosphere puts this a notch above, and obviously the now classic Austin Bret match. For some reason, I was a bit of a Sid mark back then when I saw this, probably because I didn't like the babyface HBK. I wouldn't think of this show immediately if I was going to watch a classic pay-per-view, but overall a fairly important show in the evolution of the WWF. And we'll finish off with Alan Gaynor. The Iron Sheik and Uncle Zebekiah both at ringside for a match? I'm sold. I really do miss the Survivor Series format. Would be nice if the WWE were to allow at least two of these matches on the pay-per-view this year to give the event the unique feel it used to have. When Kofi won his elimination match in 2009 by pinning Punk and Orton, it really put him over for about a week. This event reminds me that Sid used to be tolerable. I liked him during this time period and generally before that. It wasn't until he started cutting 10-minute nonsensical promos in 1999 WCW that I leapt off his bandwagon. If you guys are looking to review a September event, maybe I'd like to recommend Unforgiven 2005 with Angle versus Cena, not to mention Kerwin White, Snitsky, and Rosie. Well, quite the sell job there, Alan Gaynor, with those last three ideas. So that's all the feedback for this week, everyone. I want to thank everyone for sending in your thoughts. You can always post them at reviewaway.com, which you can just look up on Facebook. It is the facebook.com/reviewaway is where you can find it there. And, of course, all your news can be found at liveaudiowrestling.com. Next week, Wei Ting returns. And for those that have been following and are good with dates like myself,
Next week is our 2-year anniversary show. So we are going to maybe reminisce a bit about show number one. We might go back and take a listen to show number one and see where this show has evolved from that fateful September 13th, 2009 show where we reviewed Ground Zero from 1997. So we're going to chat a bit about that. Wei Ting is coming back. But what are we going to review? Well, everyone, I've teased it online, and this is going to be one of those reviews where I guarantee people will either love it or more likely hate it. But me and Wei are going to review the Hogan Knows Best porn parody and maybe even be joined by Jason Agnew, because I can't imagine doing a porn review without Jason Agnew's expertise on the breakdown of said parody. So that's going to be coming up next week, everyone. As always, you can follow me on Twitter at Law Radio. Big thank you once again to Arto Ocal. Catch Aftermath Radio Monday night at thescore.com's radio section at radio.thescore.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at @Arta_Ocal. That's all for me this week, everyone. I guess I got to pick a song to go out with because I'm doing all the stuff to wrap this up. You know what? In honor of Wei Ting, what else can we play other than this?